Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. And I'm joined today by Mike Clancy, who is a friend of the show and who is back again to co-host. Mike Clancy is the current chair of the Monterey County chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby and serves on the question review team for the annual Leon Panetta Lecture Series. He has authored over 100 publications and is the recipient of the Navy's highest civilian award, the Distinguished Civilian Service Award. Hi, Mike. Thank you for joining me again. You were a terrific co-host on the last show when we discussed warnings, the Holocaust, Ukraine, and the endangered American democracy. I'm delighted you're back co-hosting with me again today.
Well, thanks, Jill. I love doing this, and I love your show, and I'm really looking forward to today's program. We've got a wonderful guest.
Thank you. And today's program is Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. As our distinguished guest states today, we don't need to rely just on climate scientists anymore to warn us that we are in a code red emergency. The news is undeniably grim. Raging wildfires, record-breaking temperatures, monster storms, and any number of other climate-related disasters warn us regularly that we are barreling toward environmental ruin. Yet, Dr. John J. Berger also insists that rescue is possible. In his new book, Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth, he introduces us to the bold, practical, proven solutions that are ready to scale right now. And he profiles the scientists, ranchers, business leaders, community organizers, activists, engineers, farmers, and yes, politicians who are implementing them. We have big things to do. Mike, why don't you introduce our guest?
Our guest today is Dr. John J. Berger. Dr. Berger is an environmental science and policy specialist, prize-winning author, and journalist. A graduate of Stanford and the University of California, he has written and edited 11 books, including three previous books on climate change, and has written over 100 articles on climate change and transitioning to clean energy. His journalism has appeared in Scientific American, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, and many others. He has been a consultant to the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences, corporations, utilities, and the U.S. Congress. John co-founded the Nuclear Information and Resource Service to assist citizen safe energy groups and founded Restoring the Earth to bring an environmental restoration to national attention. Learn more about our guest at johnjberger.com. Welcome to Be Bold America, Dr. Berger.
Thank you very much, Michael. And it's a pleasure to be here, Michael and Jill.
Well, we're so happy to have you. And I want to get something out of the way right up front, and that is congratulations on the book. I think it's wonderful. It's a tour de force of what we need to do to make the transition to clean energy and deal with climate change. I'm going to recommend it highly to all my CCL colleagues.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And coincidentally, I just saw the book for the first time yesterday when a box of them arrived at my house. Those are just a few advanced copies. It's not officially going to be pumped until October 24th.
Well, that's exciting, and you have a lot to be proud of.
Yep. Dr. Berger, this is Jill, and I wanted to say how nice it is to meet you on the air and how exciting it must have been to open that box yesterday.
It certainly was. I was surprised by the heft of it. And if I need a doorstop, I think I found my solution.
I know how excited when I got a copy of my first book, America Abandoned, and I opened it in the box and I went, oh my gosh, you know, it's like birthing a baby. Mm-hmm. You've spent so much time. Dr. Berger, you have written a seminal book. It is authoritative, comprehensive, and a highly readable account of solutions that we have possible today. You begin the first part of the book with mega threats and breakthrough solutions. Is that where you would like to begin?
Well, I would actually like to begin with what are some of the key findings of the book. And
please do.
Maybe provide an overview of that and maybe work in why I wrote the book and what I'm hoping the book will accomplish.
Perfect.
Essentially, if that's okay with you, I would say that my most important finding was that the world could really save trillions of dollars on its energy bill and could put tens of millions of people to work and then avoid trillions of dollars in global warming damages while also saving millions of lives and stabilizing energy costs and making us really energy self-sufficient, not just self-sufficient per se, but self-sufficient in terms of clean and renewable energy self-sufficiency. And the bonus would be doing that, we would also restabilize the climate. And I think that what I've tried to do in the book is to show that using only wind and water and solar energy resources without needing any nuclear power or carbon combustion of any kind, we could now provide for 100% of our energy needs. So basically, decarbonizing our economy now is smarter, easier, and it's more profitable and far cheaper than accepting a climate nightmare. Moreover, as renewable energy costs keep falling, the chances for cooperation on clean renewable energy between blue and red states is only going to increase. I know that some people on the left have contended that we have to do away with capitalism in order to solve the climate crisis. But what I found is that although we're going to need more government action in the energy arena, capitalism is not incompatible with solving the climate crisis. But I also found that no single technology, no single policy, no single silver bullet of any kind, if you will, can save the climate. But with an aroused citizenry and silver buckshot, the kind that I describe in all areas of the economy in my book, I think that we can significantly decrease our greenhouse gas emissions to the point that the global temperature stops increasing and eventually through natural processes, it will begin to decline, barring the unexpected eruption of some natural feedback process that we don't expect to happen. From a scientific point of view, the current latest science is that if we are able to stop our increases in greenhouse gas emissions, within 2 or 3 years, the temperature will stop rising, and thereafter, it will begin to gradually decline as natural greenhouse gas removal processes kick in. Getting back to why I wrote the book, I wanted to convey the idea that we shouldn't despair, even though very serious damage has been done to the climate system and the climate undeniably has been badly disrupted. But I wanted to give people a sense that what we need to do is accelerate the clean energy transition and that we can overcome the crisis that we're in today. We cannot undo damage that has already been done, but we can prevent further, more serious damage that would occur if we did nothing, basically, to stop the processes that we have now set in motion.
Let me jump in with a two-part question, Dr. Berger. Given all the information you gathered for this book, which was certainly substantial, what single thing are you most optimistic about, and what single thing are you most pessimistic about?
I think that I'm most optimistic about the fact that we can cost-effectively get all the energy we need for every need in society by relying on our abundant and domestic supplies of clean, renewable energy from the sun, from the wind, from the earth itself in terms of geothermal energy, from fresh water in terms of hydroelectric power, and from the ocean itself in terms of some fairly new technologies for harvesting wave energy. And there are older technologies for harvesting tidal energy, but the places on the on the coastline where that can be cost-effectively done seem to be rather limited. So I'm very encouraged about that. And I'm also encouraged by the fact that we are already seeing a very rapid transition to clean energy in terms of the rates of growth of solar and wind and other technologies that bring us energy services that we need, but far more efficiently than we've been accustomed to in the past. And that enables us to reduce our carbon footprint and still provide for the heating and cooling and the warm showers and the cold drinks, so to speak, that we need.
And what are you pessimistic about?
What am I most worried about? I think I'm most worried about the fact that the big banks, multinational banks, are continuing to fund fossil fuel expansion. And there are some giant carbon bombs that are in the process of being funded and that are going online, which do have the capacity to undermine our current programs to reduce carbon emissions. And these projects are being funded in the aggregate to the tune of trillions of dollars. And if that continues unabated without intervention, then we will really lose our opportunity to implement the very practical, cost-effective, and accessible solutions that we now have and that we could scale up to basically, in a fairly short period of time as these things go, reduce our carbon emissions pretty much virtually zero.
And let me just slip in before the break a question, because we're talking about banks. And lately, to see if you have an opinion on this, lately the insurance companies have been pulling out of a lot of states and not insuring homes. Many have State Farm farmers out of California, Florida, Virginia. People can't find homeowners insurance. What do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm appalled by that, and I find it very disturbing. I think that it has a silver lining in that it will induce people to be more conscious of the risks that they're taking by locating homes in fire-prone areas. And some people will decide that it's just not practical to live in certain places that they would otherwise be willing to live in if they were able to socialize the risk of living there. So it's, in a sense, a very difficult dilemma, and I think that probably states and perhaps the federal government may have to step in to provide some insurance so that people will not be left completely devastated if disaster strikes in some of these locations. On the other hand, I don't think that government insurance can basically make people 100% whole for the damages that they might sustain, because again, that creates a moral hazard and people will feel essentially immune to the risks and may take more risks than they otherwise should if they had to bear some of that responsibility and consequence.
Thank you. You are listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today is Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. And we're speaking with Dr. John J. Berger, author of Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. Dr. Berger is an environmental science and policy specialist, prize-winning author, and journalist. Visit johnjberger.com to learn more. And my guest co-host, Mike Clancy, is the chair of the Monterey County Chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Did you know that six corporations own 90% of the media in the United States? Isn't it about time we own some, too? KSQD 90.7 FM, your community radio station, your voice, your concerns. Go to www.ksqd.org to get involved and support locally owned grassroots community media. KSQD, KSQD FM.
What to Be features college students interviewing creative, surprising, passionate people about their careers. If you have ever wondered what to be, please join us Sundays, 7 p.m., KSQD, 90.7 FM. We're back. This live Be Bold America show is also a podcast that's available on Apple, Google, Spotify, and is on many other platforms, including YouTube. Please follow our podcast and share with a friend. That's how we grow. Even though social media sites abound, word of mouth is the best advertiser. Now, Dr. Berger, I know that Mike has a question for you about climate denialism. Mike?
Yes. Yeah, Dr. Berger, I think you'll agree that climate change denial and climate change deniers, particularly those in leadership positions in government, are impeding progress on addressing the climate crisis. Here are some facts and figures and quotes to illustrate this. There are 139 elected officials in the 117th Congress, including 109 representatives and 30 senators, who refuse to acknowledge the scientific evidence of human-caused climate change. Here are some recent quotes from members of Congress. From Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama, "There is a very scientific word for this. It's called summer. It's no hotter right now than it's ever been." When he was asked about the smoke from Canadian wildfires, "We've had fires for all of our life. Come on." House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Republican of Louisiana, "Only in Washington will they try to find an excuse to take something that's been going on for hundreds of years to promote their crazy left agenda," unquote. And finally, Senator John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana, asked if extreme heat is linked to climate change, quote, "I don't think anybody knows," unquote. So I think you'll agree that this is a big problem. What do we do about it?
Well, it is a big problem, and I think that there are ways to attack it on a number of levels. The fact that representatives who are in positions of great political power and influence would espouse views like this is truly appalling, and it reveals a very deep ignorance, not only of climate science, but the methods and the scientific approach. And it is really an irrational approach to the world today. Ignoring the tremendous body of knowledge about climate science and just flying by the seat of the pants and not really doing their homework, not reading anything about climate science. If they had cracked a book on this subject, they would certainly know the difference between seasonal changes in climate and changes in long-term climate. They would know the difference between weather and climate change, weather being simply this transient phenomenon and climate being long-range weather.
Yes.
But we have billions of observations and tens of thousands of scientific studies demonstrating that climate change is human-caused, climate change is real, climate change is accelerating, climate change is dangerous. And there have been times in history, the geologic past, when the climate has made similar shifts, but it had generally been over very long periods of geological time.
Yes, definitely.
Although there have been periods hundreds of thousands of years ago when the climate did suddenly shift 7 or 12 degrees within a period of a decade. That was a very exceptional period, but we seem to be on a path to replicate something like that in the modern era as a result of the human deluge of greenhouse gases, which we're pouring into the atmosphere and thereby capturing more of the incoming solar radiation and heating up the Earth. So climate denial is a phenomenon that has been stoked for profit by the fossil fuel industry. It's a groundless, spurious bunch of nonsense that was cooked up by the fossil fuel industry and then invested in heavily to the tune of many millions of dollars, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars over a period of decades.
Yes.
It has materially impeded our ability to address the climate crisis. Going back a little bit in history, climate deniers and their industry allies in the fossil fuel industry, as early as 1993, opposed the carbon fee that was proposed by the Clinton administration. And that carbon fee actually passed the House of Representatives, but was then killed in the Senate as a result of industry opposition. And they also later in 1997 engineered the failure of Congress to ratify the 1997 Kyoto Protocol,
right,
which was a very modest international agreement that would have provided a minimalistic reduction in greenhouse gas emissions of 5%. But Congress would not ratify that after the intensive lobbying of the fossil fuel industry and the climate deniers that they have encouraged.
That's right. And you know, the other striking thing here is the parallels between the way the fossil fuel industry has behaved and the way the tobacco industry behaved in the 50s and 60s. Same deal. They engaged with lobbyists. They engaged with PR firms to deny the science, to create doubt about the science for as long as they could, to impede progress. And that seems to be exactly what's happening. In fact, in some cases, the fossil fuel industry has employed some of the same PR firms that the tobacco industry employed back in the 60s and 70s.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that this strategy was very well described in a book by Naomi Oreskes,
yes,
called Masters of Deceit.
Yes.
She had a co-author whose name I can't recall. And it was used, the strategy of creating doubt and confusion and skepticism led to a delay,
yes,
in implementing health regulations that would have protected people from the dangers of tobacco smoke.
Exactly.
And during decades of delay that resulted from the tobacco industry's campaign of sowing doubt, about 100 million Americans died from smoking-related diseases.
Yep.
In the case of climate doubt and denialism, I've written about that in a book called Climate Myths, the Campaign Against Climate Science, and Michael Mann has also written about that,
yes,
in his The New Climate Wars. I've watched this for decades, and the industry has created a series of narratives. First, their narrative was that climate, it doesn't change, and that the climate has a natural changing cycle, but that we can't influence the changes in climate. And some people went a step further and said only God can change the climate. The narrative then became climate isn't warming, it's actually cooling. Then it was climate is changing, but it's all a natural process, and it's always occurring. Next, it was the climate might be changing. Maybe it's a little warmer, but it's not any significant difference or threat. Finally, it was humans might have some effect on the climate, but not very much. And then, yes, the climate is changing, but there's nothing we can do about it. And then after that, well, we could do something about it, but it would be too costly and it would ruin the economy if we did. So these myths and forms of denial keep morphing. But essentially, it's the fossil fuel industry behind it all, trying to prevent really meaningful action on climate change that might reduce the consumption and burning of fossil fuels and thereby reduce their own profits.
I absolutely agree.
And just to slip in here again before another break and to stay at the I guess, the behavioral level. I wanted to know from your viewpoint what your thoughts are. When I read stories such as, and I'll name three, just this week I read or learned of that next month, you know, the firefighters in California and throughout the West may be seeing a 50% pay cut. And we have wildfires burning in Oregon and California, you know, in the California border with Oregon right now, and the smoke of which we are seeing and breathing at this moment on the California Central Coast. That's one story that I read this week. Another was that about our $200 million commercial fishing industry in California may be the state's first big casualty of the climate crisis. And I also heard a story, learned this morning, as a matter of fact, that cities are sinking because of the heat underneath them. Northwestern University discovered that Chicago is sinking due to the climate crisis because of the heat under the downtown. What is your advice when we are bombarded with stories such as these every day? Help us cope, Dr. Berger.
My goodness. I feel the same anguish and the same pain when I hear stories like this, and I think I'm just as upset as anyone. But the way I deal with it is I try to take some meaningful action. I know that personally I can only put a drop in the bucket, but I'd like to try to put it in the right bucket, and I'm encouraged by the fact that we have the potential to cope with this problem, and I think that Al Gore has referred to a political tipping point where such a large mass of people begins to truly understand the nature of this problem, the nature of the solutions, and basically says enough is enough, we are not going to take it anymore. And they go out, they organize, they put powerful pressure on the political system so that it has to bend and has to do the right thing. When all else fails, it will ultimately do the right thing. But we're in a situation, we're chatting relatively comfortably on the radio about climate solutions this afternoon, and at the same time, as you have indicated, a real-world existential climate time bomb is ticking. And climate change affects us across the board. It's like a sledgehammer to delicate ecosystems, to natural resources, to agricultural systems that we all depend on. It's basically a multiplier of virtually all the ecosystem and national security threats that we have, including risks to our critical infrastructure, to supply chains, to international stability, to the global economy. Climate disruption is already, as you pointed out, and I'm breathing the same bad air that you've been breathing. It impacts every aspect of our lives and our livelihoods. It imperils our homes, our jobs, our security, our health, and our future. And it increasingly diminishes the quality of our daily lives and our working environments and our recreational opportunities. So this is a vast and sort of everything all at once problem. And an existential one, so we have to master it, and we all have to gear up and do whatever is necessary to make sure that we stop aggravating the problem and stop digging the hole we're already in any deeper. And that's why I wrote the book. I want to see us accelerate the transition to a clean energy economy, which I believe is entirely possible. And if we don't do that, we're headed in a terrible direction that it's already bad as a result of the numerous climate catastrophes that we're seeing in front of us. And we have 8 million people dying around the world already from fossil fuel-created air pollution and others from extreme weather or from having to leave their homes because they can't make a living because of drought or some other change in climate. But But even when I said we're facing an existential crisis, I really mean that quite literally. If we do not get a handle on the dangerous trends that we are seeing, we may find ourselves in a situation with so much disruption and so much chaos that we become basically ungovernable. And at this point, we're heading towards a situation as early as 2070, when combinations of extreme heat and high humidity will create basically unsurvivable conditions for 1 to 3 billion people or more on the planet periodically at any time in any given year.
Your answer reminds me of one of my favorite Dr. Stephen Covey concepts, which is, because we're all overwhelmed by this when we talk about things at an existential level. And one of his concepts was circle of concern, circle of influence. And we're concerned about what's happening. And he would say, when you're concerned about something, that's where stress is, that's where paralyzing behaviors happen. But circle of influence is brings it back to you on what can I do? You know, what specifically can I help send money to organizations, organization like 350.org? So I think that we need to just remind ourselves of our circle of influence. You are listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 89.5, 89.7. and 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today is Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. And we're speaking with Dr. John J. Berger, author of Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. My guest co-host, Mike Clancy, and our distinguished and bold guest, Dr. John J. Berger, will be right back after Jim Hightower's commentary titled The Day the Planet Started to Win.
The people are revolting, in the very best meaning of that word. An inspiring example of people rising up against a trifecta of economic, cultural, and political oppression has just come to us from a community of seemingly powerless people living in a very isolated place. Long exploited, lied to, disrespected, and robbed, they revolted, daring to take on the biggest, richest, most politically connected industrial power on the globe, Big Oil. Astonishingly, after a decade of protesting, organizing, coalition building, suing, petitioning, and otherwise resolutely rebelling against injustice, these tenacious people just won an inspiring grassroots victory over Big Oil profiteering. One reason you probably haven't heard about it is that it didn't happen in any of the usual centers of media focus, but in the Amazonian rainforest of Ecuador. Also, this revolt was not led by some brand-name environmental group or charismatic political honcho, but by the Tagere and Taro-Manani tribes and other indigenous Warani people living in the rich biodiversity of Ecuador's Yosemite National Park. Directly challenging the exigent crisis of climate change, the Warani rallied the region's young people into a potent political force. They successfully organized behind a national referendum to 1. Ban oil drilling in the region, 2. Compel the profiteers to remove their wells and pipelines, and 3. Pay for remediation and reforestation. Significantly, they specifically called for leaving oil in the ground so it would not add to climate destruction. And the proposed ban was binding, unable to be overturned by future lobbyists and officials. This is Jim Hightower saying, a resounding 58% of Ecuadorians said yes. As a Warani leader noted, this is the day the planet started to win. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
If you're just joining us, our topic today is Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth, and our guest is Dr. John J. Berger. Now, Mike, you had some specific questions on geoengineering and nuclear power.
Yes.
What are they?
Yeah, well, let's go down in the weeds a little bit, Dr. Berger. And first question is, what's your view on the future of nuclear power, particularly fourth-generation nuclear power plants and small modular reactors?
Okay, well, I've been following the nuclear industry for decades, and there are tremendous problems with conventional large nuclear power plants, which means those that are over 700 megawatts in size, often 1,000 megawatts in size. And these power plants are in many ways an endangered species, and rightly so. We haven't been building any appreciable number of new power plants of nuclear design since the 1970s. I think maybe one or two with heavy government subsidization have been constructed. And I would suggest that before we talk about fourth-generation nuclear power plants, which are really very much experimental and in various stages of research and development, but not commercially ready, let's look at small modular reactors, which would be second and third generation, probably third generation nuclear reactors. And those would be on the order of 300 megawatts in size, roughly a third to 40% of today's large nuclear power plants. None of these are in commercial operation in the United States, so this isn't a commercially available energy option. In contrast to solar or wind or geothermal or hydro or battery and energy storage, including green hydrogen, these technologies, as I say, are over the horizon, and I would hesitate to bank on them because I've watched the nuclear industry over decades, always promising something that would be clean, cheap, safe, and effective. And instead, while the renewable technologies have fallen in price, the price of nuclear power has continued to increase to the point that it's more cost-effective to build a clean solar photovoltaic plant, for example, than it is to even operate some of these large, older plants that are troubled with frequent outages and that have safety problems. Inherent, though, in the nuclear enterprise is this complexity and the danger of a small malfunction replicating or cascading into a common mode failure in which you basically lose control of the reactor. It's a very, quote, unlikely event, and yet has happened a number of times in the history of the nuclear industry. So while I am not calling for us to shut down existing large nuclear reactors, I think that it doesn't make sense to build more large nuclear reactors at five times the cost of producing a safer, cleaner, faster, easier to construct alternative, which would be any number of the renewable technologies backed by energy storage. But cycling back to the question of these small modular reactors, the theory is that there would be a great advantage to having these plants standardized in their design so that you could construct them basically in factories and then send them out onto the landscape. This, unfortunately, has never been commercially validated. And I think it's very likely these plants would wind up being more expensive than the alternative cleaner technologies. And I keep referring to, I create a juxtaposition between the cleaner renewable technologies and nuclear technologies, because similar to the conventional reactors that we're using today, these small modular reactors would still produce highly toxic, long-lived radioactive waste, for which we don't have a federally approved or even a socially accepted disposal option. And they would also, like large plants, be vulnerable to attack by terrorists and to damage from earthquakes and from extreme weather that could potentially result in the release of large toxic plumes of radiation. since we don't have adequate storage for long for high-level radioactive waste, there's quite a bit of it sitting in what's known as interim storage at nuclear power plants, and they're vulnerable to all kinds of natural disasters. But intrinsically, these small nuclear reactors, because of their smaller size and their topology, if you will, they're going to experience more neutron leakage than conventional reactors, and that leakage affects the amount, the composition of their waste. So essentially, studies have found that small modular reactors will generate at least 9 times more neutron-activated steel than conventional power plants. And these are radioactive materials that have to be carefully managed prior to disposal. That's going to be expensive.
I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about geoengineering. What do you see as the pluses and minuses of geoengineering, particularly stratospheric aerosol injection, which is, of course, a form of solar radiation management?
You're absolutely right on that. And in that form of solar radiation management, engineers would mimic certain natural volcanic cooling processes. For example, in a large volcanic eruption, the volcano blasts large amounts of sulfurous gases into the atmosphere. These gases then form tiny, shiny aerosolized particles of sulfur dioxide, and these then reflect sunlight away from the Earth back into space and thereby cool the planet for a relatively short period of time. I don't remember precisely, it's probably on the order of 1 to 3 years. So in human-induced stratospheric aerosol injection, people would use balloons or aircraft or rockets to spray sulfates into the atmosphere to lower the Earth's temperature, and they would do that if they felt that we were in an emergency situation where temperature had gotten intolerably high as a result of our failure to control our emissions and reduce the amount of already present atmospheric greenhouse gas. The thought here is that behind this whole concept is that since the sun heats up the Earth, why not just get rid of some of this extra sunlight and cool the Earth? And it does have a plausible ring to it. And also in favor of this idea is the fact that for a few billion dollars a year, you could get fairly significant reductions in global temperature as long as we continue to inject that extra sulfur into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. However, this could be environmentally dangerous and addictive and ultimately expensive and morally hazardous. First of all, it would mask the effects of the excess greenhouse gas in the air without addressing its underlying cause or actually reducing it. So it might give us a false sense of security. And during that time, the oceans would continue to acidify because of the high concentration mm-hmm. of carbon dioxide already in the atmosphere. And meanwhile, with the climate appearing to improve, we might have even less motivation to reduce our fossil fuel combustion. Second, there's a likelihood that by reflecting sunlight away from the Earth and changing the pattern of sunlight on the Earth, we might alter the planet's rainfall pattern and displace monsoons so that needed rain would fall over the ocean while, for example, leaving part of Southeast Asia in drought. Or alternatively, it might provoke a disastrously wet monsoon season causing terrible flooding. In addition, this is very serious, as if that wasn't serious, mimicking volcanic discharges year after year, in contrast to the episodic nature of volcanic discharges, the continuous discharge of sulfur will cause the destruction of the stratospheric ozone layer,
yes,
which is critical to protecting all life on Earth from ultraviolet radiation that causes cancers and cataracts and damages plants and crops that we depend on.
I absolutely agree with all of that. And I'll just add another big problem is there will be winners and losers in terms of the countries of the world if we engage in a large effort there. For example, you mentioned the monsoon. The Indian monsoon might collapse, and you know billions of people rely on that to live. So there's a lot of challenges there. Thanks for that.
My co-host Michael Clancy and I are speaking with Dr. John J. Berger, author of Solving the Climate Crisis: Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. And Dr. Berger is consultant to the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences and to Corporations and Utilities and the U.S. Congress. Learn more about Dr. Berger at johnjberger.com. You are listening to Be America on KSQD 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Are you concerned about the Earth's future? Are you interested in what is being done in the Monterey Bay Area to address environmental issues? Then tune in to Sustainability Now with host Ronnie Lipschitz. Every other Sunday at 5 p.m. on KSQD, he interviews area scientists, scholars, activists, and officials involved in pursuing sustainability. That's next Sunday at 5 p.m. here on KSQD 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM and KSQD.org.
We're back. And Dr. Berger, usually, you know, in this quarter hour, we like to ask our guests what we could keep doing, stop doing, and start doing. But I know Mike has a quote that you wrote in your book that he'd like to talk to you about.
Yes, I came across this quote in your concluding chapter. I thought it was very powerful and very relevant to the general themes that are covered on this show. So let me read it back to you and then get you to comment further on it. So the quote is, "A danger to democracy is a danger to the clean energy transition. An early goal of the climate movement, therefore, must be safeguarding elections, the bedrock of democracy, and making sure that the public fully understands the value of democracy and the price that has been paid to preserve it." Can you comment further on that?
I think it's absolutely essential that we protect our democracy and the right to vote and the right to express our political opinions. Otherwise, if we allow this country to gravitate towards an authoritarian system in which control over the country and its resources and its policy is concentrated in the hands of a few very extreme right-wing wealthy individuals and corporations, then there is no hope of putting meaningful federal climate policy in place. And because we are in such a tight corner, if you will, we have not had great success yet in our international diplomacy. Let's say that there has been some diplomatic progress, but at the same time, we're seeing the conditions in the atmosphere continue to worsen, and the load of greenhouse gas continue to become more of a burden on the atmosphere and the natural climate system. We therefore cannot really afford to lose control over the United States, which is one of the forerunners along with the European Union in advancing progressive climate policy, as exemplified by the Inflation Reduction Act that Joe Biden just succeeded in getting Congress to pass. So I think it would be disastrous if government in the United States kind of reverted to what Donald Trump had done when he called climate change a hoax. He withdrew the U.S. from the 195-nation 2015 Global Paris Climate Accord and opposed all climate measures and weakened all environmental regulations. And basically, we had no meaningful new federal climate initiatives. And Trump cost America 4 years of foregone federal action. And we just cannot afford that. And that's the kind of policy that we would get from an authoritarian right-wing government in which a minority ruled over this nation. And it could happen if we do not really mobilize
public and get out and become very deeply engaged politically. And I know this taps right into Jill's interest in what we ought to do, what we should keep doing, stop doing, and start doing. And I've given some thought to that question that you sent me, Jill.
Oh, thank you.
to talk about it anytime you'd like.
Oh, no, we're ready to do that. You have a chapter on what we can do to stabilize the climate, and you have another chapter with to-do lists. And how can we help? How can, you know, what are your key keep, stop, starts? Or as one of your sections in the book was titled, The Road Out of Hell. What is our road out of hell?
Well, it's really different depending on who you are. And what we're, I'm looking at this now as I think you wanted me to focus on ordinary listeners, not on people running big corporations or holding political office, because I do have a chapter on policy, but then I do address what ordinary folks should do. And of course, everyone is different, and some of us are in powerful positions, others are doing necessary but humble jobs. And I think the important thing is, no matter who we are, that we all show up as powerfully and authentically as we can in our own way and do something. We can all do something. But to sit idly by and do nothing because, and here you can fill in the blank with your own favorite excuse, and I don't mean you personally, of course, but my own favorite excuses, but it's not acceptable at this time of national and global crisis. So with that as sort of a larger frame around the answer, I think that in terms of what we should keep doing, we need to keep informed about what's going on in the nation and the world as it affects our climate and energy policy and our democracy. And we can't turn away from the news because sometimes it's difficult or upsetting to watch. As the late Wes Nisker once said, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. So I think we need to do that now, and we need to keep learning about the nature of the climate crisis we face and its root causes and its solutions, and then educate others on these issues. So that's what I think we should keep doing. Basically, stay engaged with the political process, keep your voter registration up to date, actually go vote in all elections, urge your elected representatives to vigorously support ambitious climate solutions, and let them know that your vote depends on their support for a quick, clean energy transition, and get them on the record publicly, and then vote for those candidates who take a meaningful stand on, and take meaningful action on climate issues, and hold representatives accountable by sharing your views with them through letters, phone calls, personal appearances at the town halls, et cetera. I think in terms of what we should stop doing, that was another aspect of your question, I would say don't panic at how bad things have gotten. We are obviously in a climate emergency, but in an emergency, panic is the last thing that's needed. We need instead clear, rational thought and purposeful, determined action. I think don't despair that there's nothing meaningful that can be done to protect the climate, because that's emphatically not true. As I said at the outset, once we cease all our emissions within 2 or 3 years, the latest science tells us the temperature will stop rising. So don't let doomsayers frighten you into cynicism. The cynic is someone who says without foundation that everything is already lost, and they use that belief to justify their own inaction and then to question the motives of everyone who is trying to do their best to protect the Earth. Finally, I would say don't be misled that your lifestyle choices alone are going to save the climate, and that if you can't do them, for example, for financial or other reasons, then you are responsible for the climate crisis, because that's a myth that fossil fuel industry would like you to swallow. Moreover, don't believe that little green gestures like taking a cloth bag to the grocery store, riding a bike, walking more, drying your laundry on the line, whatever, are going to save the climate. I wish they would. Don't get me wrong. I'm in favor of doing all those worthy things, and most of them would be good for you, but and they make you feel good. They're of some benefit when aggregated millions or hundreds of millions of time, but they still fall far short of what we can accomplish if we put our main energy and hope into organizing for the massive policy changes that we need to make in order to quickly transform our economy to 100% clean energy. So do all of those good things and start doing some other news. For example, when you make a major investment at home or work that has the potential to create a large carbon footprint, like the purchase of a home or a car or home heating or cooling system, major appliance, shop carefully for those that have the least energy and environmental impact. If you have a yard or a garden, maybe you can set aside some space for native plants that provide needed habitat for native pollinators and for birds. I happen to raise seedlings in pots in my yard and give them away. And perhaps your community might even find some land to plant a biodiverse mini forest that has a lot of environmental benefits. But in terms of organizing, join, support, and participate in community, local, national, and grassroots environmental and climate organizations that are engaged in climate issues and in democracy protection. A national organization I like a lot is the Center for Biological Diversity, and also 350.org, and a version of it called Third Act for Older People. Three progressive democracy organizations that I like are Swing Left, Vote Forward, and the Progressive Turnout Project.
Dr. Berger, we are running out of time, and you are going to get the first gold star for the best keep, stop, starts that I've had on this program in 5 years. You get the Gold Star Award because that was just wonderful. I wanted to thank you for being our bold and impressive guest today. You have written such an authoritative and comprehensive book. It could be a university textbook. To learn more about Dr. Berger's book, please visit johnjberger.com. Thank you, Dr. Berger.
You're very welcome, Jill. If I could give you a short plug, I'd like to recommend the website solvingtheclimatecrisis.us.
Oh, perfect.
Which is entirely focused on the book, solvingtheclimatecrisis.us.
Crisis.us. I just wrote it down. Okay. And speaking for Mike and myself, it has been an honor for us to interview you again. Thank you. Mike, you have a closing?
Yeah, once again, Dr. Berger, congratulations on the book. I think it's going to have a big impact.
And I want to thank program engineer Eliza James, and a very special thank you to my guest, Michael Clancy. You are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Broomdale. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online, ksqd.org. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.